Burası Ahval. Doğru haberciliğin ve özgür yorumların odak noktası. Podcast yayınımıza hoş geldiniz.
Hello and welcome to Hot Pursuit, part of Ahval podcast series and video series. Today we gathered here again to talk about the events circulating around Turkey, which are real stories in depth that should be approached in depth. I have two guests with me from Washington, D.C. Merve Tahiroğlu is the Turkey coordinator with Project on Middle East and Democracy. Welcome, Merve.
Thank you.
And Associate Professor Sinan Ciddi is with the Marine Corps University in Virginia, Washington, D.C. Hello, Sinan.
Hello there.
Well, let's begin with the most spectacular event that was introduced to the world in 24th of July, reopening of Ayasofya as a mosque, reconversion of the monumental building, which is part of the global cultural heritage, one of the most magnificent constructions that have been visited by millions and millions over the decades and centuries. And the reconversion of Ayasofya as a mosque was, of course, meant to be a big ceremony, big event, in order to reassert the image of President Erdogan and his cadres of the AKP. And crowds have gathered outside the monument on Thursday, 24th of July. And inside the ceremony, of course, contained all the power figures of today's Turkey, Bahçeli and many other people. And 24th of July is a significant date as well. It will not have marked the reopening of Ayasofya as a mosque, but it is also significant in terms of being the anniversary of the Lausanne Treaty, which is one of the main pillars of the foundation of the modern Turkish Republic. It was not chosen randomly, this date. It was also apparently meant to send signals to the world. Let's start with Ayasofya. Let's start with Merve. What are your thoughts and comments about this big event, this groundbreaking, perhaps a game-changing event?
It was indeed groundbreaking, and I think completely justifying the level of international attention it got. I mean, not only was it a grand ceremony itself on Friday, Erdogan himself led prayers, hundreds of thousands of people actually joined it, and it was highly televised. It almost tried to communicate to Turkey's, Erdogan's domestic audience in Turkey, but also to an international crowd that Erdogan is now positioning himself as sort of a caliph, self-declared caliph, the leader of the Muslim world. And this is something that he's been wanting to do for a long time, but using Ayasofya, something, a monument that is so symbolic with so much historical significance to so many cultures was highly, not only highly symbolic, but I think is telling of how Erdogan sees himself and also how he sees Turkey. You mentioned that this coincided with the day of the Lausanne Treaty being signed, which was, of course, one of the founding documents of the Turkish Republic. This is something, and a piece of document, actually, that Turkey's Islamists have always criticized Turkey's founding fathers with not getting more out of the deal with the Western powers when Turkey's founding fathers were negotiating the terms of the republic that they were creating. And this was right after a major Turkey was coming out of, and it basically set the terms of what the Turkish Republic would look like for the next 100 years. And Islamists have always leveled several criticisms of this deal throughout the last 100 years, and most of the times it's even based on conspiratorial thinking and not even actual facts governing this document. So Erdogan, by coinciding this conversion of this very important building for so many cultures that have come through Turkish territory and the multiple empires, the two grand empires that Istanbul has over his history has played the capital of, he's not only turning a page behind this important history that Istanbul and Turkey represents of multiculturalism and everything about that, but also to the beginning of the Turkish Republic, what we might potentially call the first Turkish Republic. And this is almost as if the inauguration of the second republic that is going to be Erdogan's.
Mm-hmm. Sinan?
Yeah, I mean, just looking at the visuals coming out of July 24, we can say several things. Based on both of what you said, first of all, Erdogan knew precisely that it would garner a strong international response, mainly negative. And this is what he was aiming for, precisely because it essentially galvanizes public opinion towards positivity towards him in the short term. And that's precisely why he did this. Reflecting on the crowds.
Is it all about domestic politics?
Of course, yeah. I mean, at this point, you know, if you look at the sort of crowds that were like celebrating and running down, chanting Islamic cheers across the street, it was a crowd that was sort of drunken with ignorance, as best as I can put it. And I don't mean that in a demeaning sense, although it is somewhat demeaning. I understand that. But, you know, why? What is the basis of celebrating this? Okay, let's just check, based on what Mara said. The Lausanne Treaty, there is so much ignorance around this. This is basically possibly a failing of Turkey's education system to sort of hammer out and basically make people remember what this is all about, what it stands for. If you ask the average person in the United States, what does 1776 mean to you? What does July 4th mean to you, right? The Declaration of Independence. You're going to have a variety of opinion, but there is going to be a consensus that this was a net positive, a gain for the United States, that it declared itself an independent and sovereign nation that was free from tyranny, right? Forget the folklore. You know, we in Turkey still don't understand or have a basic consensus as to what Lausanne helped achieve. We have all these sort of conspiracy theories that there are sort of secret sort of components to it that, you know, that basically tore away from the independence, and this wasn't as big a celebration as it should be sort of remembered for. It is a grand compromise which put Turkey on the map of the world as a state, a nascent state that gained its economic, political sovereignty, and basically, if for no other reason, the ability of Erdogan to sit in that in Hagia Sophia, for people to chant in the streets and celebrate, you know, the conversion into a mosque. None of this would be happening. None of this had Lausanne not been signed. Lausanne is the title, the deed of the country. It people forget that the last sultan of the empire signed away the keys to not only Istanbul, but for the entire Ottoman Empire, to the British Empire, and said, here you go. This is yours. I surrender. You know, the Erdogan government calls, the İnönü governments, the Atatürk governments, you know, tutelary or vesayetçi in Turkish, right?
Mm-hmm.
These two individuals resulted in Turkey gaining its sovereign independence as an equal state in the world, without which Turkey today would not exist and would be a series of divided satellite states that would have been carved up by the empires, right? Yeah. And this is conveniently forgotten, and it is not taught, and it befuddles me that we still don't have a basic understanding in Turkey what Lausanne stands for. And instead, you have a limited number of crowds in the hundreds of thousands, whatever, however sort of big they want to portray it, drunken with celebration over the conversion of a museum into a mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And my colleague, this is not my idea, but my colleague said, you know, Alan Makowski, he essentially iterated the other day saying this is not necessarily the loss of or transition from secularism in Turkey into a sort of more Islamic sort of country. And there is a component of that, I believe. But Atatürk did this in 19, you know, he converted Hagia Sophia into a museum as a peace offering to Turkey, the Ottoman Empire's former foe, the Greeks. Because he essentially looked at this and thought, we need to have peaceful relations, right? With all of our neighbors, all of our former adversaries, so we can exist as an independent sovereign state in a club of states.
Mm-hmm.
That is what has been provoked.
Well, the immediately in the aftermath of the opening, we started seeing and hearing some social media viral tweets and some cautious, discreet assertions questioning Lausanne Treaty, which, of course, one would believe, one would be inclined to assess, will gain power. Lausanne Treaty, I think, is open for debate in the coming months and years until 2023. Some would argue that the German resentment to Versailles Treaty in 1919 led to the rise of Nazis and Hitler and led to Second World War. And I was perhaps not surprised to see these immediate questioning of Lausanne Treaty as some sort of straitjacket for Turkey. And you can see that also in the expansionist tendencies or signs of through Blue Homeland, Eastern Mediterranean, etc., that Lausanne Treaty is being now more and more increasingly seen as a straitjacket. I think if you look at this from this perspective, perhaps, I don't know if you agree with me or not, Merve and Sinan, but I think what puzzles or baffles us is that the changes that take place in Turkey makes Hagia Sophia opening only a component, as you say, of the big picture, but an important step, important threshold. But I think the continuity is there of questioning each and every part of what Lausanne Treaty means, what the foundation of the Turkish Republic means. Because if you remember well, Erdogan and his cadres have been talking for a long time about the parenthesis, historic parenthesis that should be closed at some time. How do we see when we see that, when we place Hagia Sophia in reconversion into this big picture? I think it's important for the international audience to also to understand, because as little as there's knowledge in Turkey about Lausanne Treaty, as you mentioned, there's also, I think, quite a big indifference or ignorance about what Lausanne Treaty means for the stability of the southeastern flank of Europe. And also, in general, the system, the Western system. Maria?
Absolutely. I mean, questioning the Lausanne Treaty is like, and similarly, the conversion of Hagia Sophia, questioning the status of Hagia Sophia as a museum set forth by the founding fathers of Turkey. All of this is questioning essentially all of what Turkey represented previously as a nation state, as a republic, as I mentioned. There is so much disinformation around this treaty. Most I have spoken to multiple people, for example, in the last month alone, who believe things like the treaty has precluded Turkey from ever exploiting any natural gas reserves or oil or any natural resources. It precludes Turkey from conducting certain levels of trade with certain countries. All of these things that the treaty does not do is being attributed to it by really the it's always been done by the Islam. Now we're talking about the actual leaders of the country. They're propagating these notions that basically this treaty, far from setting the trajectory of the Turkish Republic, constrained Turkey, constrained its growth, as you mentioned, forced Turkey into this box from which it cannot emerge. And Erdogan has been over and again is reiterating this date, 2023, when this is supposed to expire. The idea is that after that point, he can set his own trajectory for Turkey, which is going to be, as you said, perhaps a bit more, I mean, looks like it's going to be more irredentist. It looks like it's going to be much less secular and much less interested, as Sinan mentioned, in maintaining peaceful relations with Turkey's neighbors and particularly adversaries of the former Ottoman Empire. So I think it speaks a lot, this conversion and the date and this questioning of the founding principle or the founding pillars of Turkey. A bit of a revolutionary leader in that he wants to turn Turkey into something completely new. He's already done this with his presidential system. He's already done this through various cultural policies and economic policies that he has set over the last almost 20 years. And he has his eyes set on post-2023. We will not be talking about Turkey the way we have before and after 2023. And this is one of the major inaugural steps of that new republic.
Merve, the reconversion of Ayasofya as a mosque also seems to have broken a wall. People now are expressing fear more openly after this, seculars, intellectuals, etc. I keep hearing, and I'm sure you do as well, that now that this happened, maybe soon we will see an Islamic calendar. Maybe we will see, men being able to de jure, being able to marry four women. And all of the Istanbul, again, becoming a capital soon, before 2023, or as approaching to that date. All of these agenda issues that people attribute to Erdogan and his cadres are now being expressed more and more in great deal of intimidation, sense of intimidation. Do you agree with those concerns and fears? And also the Istanbul agreement, the so-called Istanbul agreement.
I do, but I also think that they are a bit of a distraction, to be honest, because what we have been experiencing in Turkey is already, there are these important fears, of course, coming from the secular.
I think we are losing Merve, but let her come back. Sinan, can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we're hearing is it's almost the second anniversary of the transition into the presidential system, right? And what is happening is it is clear that this new system of government is not working, that governability is now an issue which is unresolvable because policy is not being effective, it is not strengthening the economy, it is not essentially shoring up the political cohesiveness of the country, and Erdogan, in the face of the pandemic, as well as economic weakness of the country, is losing voter support en masse. And as a result of that, in order to sort of shore up his political support base, he is turning to more radical extremes. Ayasofya is just one of these examples.
Okay. Is he losing control or is he gaining control?
That I cannot answer at this moment. It seems like he seems to be in control, as in still on top of the edifice of the state, but his political agenda is increasingly being held ransom by more fringe political and support bases, one of which are the Tariqats. In order to essentially mobilize their voter base and support for the government of Erdogan and his ally, the MHP, they are making more and more extreme requests of Erdogan. You know, the Ayasofya is just one thing. The cancellation of the Istanbul Agreement is likely another. The end of the equality between men and women is likely to be another. You know, there are some analysts that watch Turkey suggesting that with the Hagia Sophia, Erdogan has essentially spent his last round of essentially, you know, trying to sort of shore up his political base. I vehemently disagree with that. You know, they call us the pessimists, but so you're alluding to some of them. With the end of institutional secularism, there is nothing to suggest that Turkey's Alevi minority will not be systematically targeted in terms of actual hate speech and actual vigilante attacks, let alone other religious and ethnic minorities, which have already struggled with this sort of entity. So I think this is the beginning, because up until 2023, there are many more symbolic actions that the government can now take, right? Such as, like you suggested, making Istanbul the capital again, and ending the secular order.
Changing the alphabet.
Right. I mean, that would be extreme. Erdogan's no fool. to the extent, you know, with the Hagia Sophia comment he said last year, saying, you know, you fill up the Blue Mosque first and then we can talk to see if we need to convert Hagia Sophia into a mosque again. He doesn't believe this. He knows that it's not necessarily fruitful, but he's up against the wall electorally and politically. He needs to come up with essentially ways to essentially galvanize and mobilize public sentiment towards him. He does not have the economic means to do that, but adversarial, divisive, polarization politics seem to have worked for him this far. And I think there's nothing to suggest that they won't continue working for him in the near future. Authoritarian states do survive, and we have many examples, right, that have outlasted and defied reason and logic. Mm-hmm. I've always said this, but one critical example that outlasted numerous economic malaise and collapses is the example of Zimbabwe. You know, under Robert Mugabe, this country has experienced hyperinflation that Turkey has never experienced, mm-hmm. economic collapse that Turkey has not seen, yet the government stayed in power. There are other Central Asian republics, which probably Turkey is closer to and resembles more politically and culturally, that Turkey could go down. So I think it would be a mistake to suggest that Erdogan has spent his last round with Hagia Sophia, that because of the economic malaise that he can no longer sustain power. Mm-hmm. I would just say watch this space.
Mm-hmm. And Merve, welcome back again.
You
got interrupted, but are you sharing those thoughts of pessimism? That was my question.
I do, but actually I think maybe what I'm going to say might be a bit more sound a bit more pessimistic, but it's been very clear to me that when we talk about this Islamization and, you know, these fears that the secular factions in Turkey have, the almost paranoia that Erdogan might change the dates, the time dates, the calendar, the alphabet, all of these things, he doesn't need to do these things. I mean, Turkey under Erdogan has stopped functioning really like a secular country anyway. We have seen the kinds of Islamist groups chanting down the streets, sort of taking over the streets and dominating the streets. This has been a phenomenon really since 2016, at least in Turkey. Secular people, particularly minorities or vulnerable communities like women, LGBT, non-Sunni Muslims in Turkey have all felt incredibly intimidated by the empowered factions that believe that they are the true owners of Turkey already for so many years, and they go around with complete impunity. This is because Turkey has no rule of law. It has no intention of enforcing any kind of secular democratic system in which everybody can feel like a first-class citizen, or women, for example, can feel that the state will protect them from violent attackers, which it doesn't. And mm-hmm. so already Turkey, in my opinion, in the most significant ways that a country can stop functioning mm-hmm. as a secular one, Turkey has already passed that point. So I think while this was incredibly symbolic and significant, the conversion of Hagia Sophia, because Hagia Sophia symbolized, I think, not a Turkey that existed, but a multicultural Turkey that the founding fathers aspired for Turkey. It was never really functioning as that kind of a multicultural, diverse, pluralist state, but they envisioned that. So this is turning a page on that entire endeavor. But in terms of the Islamization of society and state, I think we're unfortunately already there, and that has to do with the lack of rule of law.
Mm-hmm. Let's complicate the picture a little further to create confusion amongst our viewers and listeners. Part of the reactions and pessimism that we are discussing is there, and all these fears of the secular Western-oriented members of the society, yet. In what Veni sees as a baffling or puzzling step, Hagia Sophia reconversion united the opposition with the AKP and MHP in many ways. There was no clear positioning by the CHP, main opposition, a party founded by the founder of the Turkish Republic, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, and also the ex-officers, some of whom spent time in prison, in Silivri, Ergenekon and Barrios, Sledgehammer, etc., etc. And those who claim to be the guardians of the secularism in Turkey have remained remarkably silent and even active in taking part in prayers in that in the monument, 24th of July. And this unification around Ayasofya, the first one was the coup d'etat attempt in 2016, again, a reunification moment, has come back. And that has, to a great deal, puzzled the West, Turkey's allies, Turkey's friends abroad. I want to hear what you think about this. This is, of course, a cultural phenomenon as much as political phenomenon. But I think it's worth revisiting and analyzing. Yes, Merve.
Jan, I think you look like you had a thought on this. I have to say, I don't quite understand the question.
The question is, how do we explain the opposition, main opposition, CHP and the E Party, not really taking a distancing themselves from this step, because especially CHP and also E Party, in their identity, there is the defense of secularism in their program, in their image.
Well, I might be a little too critical here, but I don't think so, because the main opposition has been the main opposition since 2003, and nothing has changed in the country. So I think it's safe to criticize the main opposition. Secularism, philosophically and theoretically speaking, is about democracy. It's about creating a level playing field for all factions in society. It's not really, I don't think we should, particularly laicite, that which Turkey has adopted, that strand of secularism is beyond religious divides. It should be, it's a type of principle that is about enforcing equality among a diverse group of citizens. Unfortunately, I don't believe that the CHP, Turkey's main opposition party, has ever really embodied this principle and really adopted this principle. And this is why, like their reaction to Ayasofya, their inability to say that this is not only against our own party's agenda and principles and historical actions, but they're unable to say that this is basically showing the dominance of one culture over another in Turkey with this conversion, rather than looking at all the cultures as equally important and valuable. They were unable to do this, and they're unable to do this when it comes to many, many other policies that Erdogan and the AKP and also the MHP, the nationalists and Islamists, have put forth in front of them. So this is not the first time they're reacting this way. This is a bigger problem. I think it also is it affects Turkey's foreign policy making, because we see this in a lot of foreign policy decisions, whether it's the war in Libya or military interventions in places like Idlib, for example, not just those places in Syria where there is a Kurdish insurgency a presence. With all of these things, with the Eastern Mediterranean, with the anti-Americanism, we see the main opposition, the opposition parties, allowing the reproduction of the arguments set forth and the paradigms set forth by the ruling party and by the ruling bloc, and unable to create a second alternative narrative. This, I think, is the problem with the understanding of democracy by the failure of the main opposition party to truly understand, I think, both what secularism means and what democracy means.
And Sinan, what is your take on this opposition uniting around Ayasofya move?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that came to my mind was you know, this is a hard one for them. If you know, just to put this into context, you know, since at least since the 1950s, Turkey's right-wing movements, beginning with the Democrat Party, but also prior to that, Turkey's religious sort of political activists, to the extent that they existed, have always branded the CHP as enemies of Islam. Right? If we remember with Menderes essentially, you know, converting the call to prayer back from Turkish into Arabic, all the way throughout the 60s and the 70s, there has been a pronounced effort and quite an effective sort of branding of the CHP by Turkey's right-wing parties, from the Islamist right to the nationalist right to the center-right, as essentially enemies of Islam. So it is hard for the opposition to actually make a static stand against Hagia Soviet conversion, saying, you know, this is contrary to secularism, it hurts Turkey's relations abroad. All those are given, and I agree with those, but it's extremely hard issue for these guys to sort of coalesce around. And I think Erdogan knows this, right? It's extremely difficult. That's the first point I would make. The second point is that it's something we've said before on this program. I mean, we all understand that it's extremely difficult to be a political opposition in Turkey because, like we just said, it's, you know, opposition has been like a pastime almost since 2003, with very little sort of possibility to effectively take over the reins of government. You know, the transition of power from one party to another doesn't exist in Turkey anymore. Mm-hmm. That being said, at this point, you know, I do not understand what the political opposition in Turkey has to lose, other than essentially taking a stand against the AKP and Erdogan. If you don't have a prudent and, a coalescing platform that you can put the voters as to what you stand for, rather than worry about what Erdogan's going to do to you, how Erdogan's going to brand you, as in, you know, you are an Americanist, you are anti-Islam, rather than worrying about that reaction or, you know, being cast as like a PKK lover, quote unquote, right? You know, if you want to sort of come have a dialogue with the HDP, you know, instead of worrying and fearing what's going to happen to you as a political entity, why don't you take a stand and say, this is what we stand for. We are not going to let the principles of secularism fall by. Yes, we have an issue of race relations in Turkey, ethnicity and democratic governance, but if you don't have that platform, what is the point of you existing as an opposition party, right? If Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu does not sort of, you know, have a dialogue with other parties or actually have a definitive platform as to what they stand for, I do not understand at this point in time why they continue to exist as an entity, because there seems to be very little to lose. So this constant reacting to what Erdogan is going to do to them, and hence shying away from the bigger, larger debate, is hurting them in the eyes of sort of people who are looking for an alternative.
I see. We have very little time.
Can I just add one
very briefly, because we are running out.
Yes, sorry. I mean, this is, it's not like the opposition is completely unable to do this. Selahattin Demirtaş, the core chair of the HDP, did this really well, set the narrative himself rather than reacting to Erdogan's narrative. İmamoğlu, the mayor of Istanbul, did this during the campaign just last year in the re-election. Every time Erdogan tried to portray him as a Greek lover, etc., he hugged Greek people and said, yes, I do, like, Greek people, you know, reacted in a way where he accepted it. So I think the opposition can do it. Every time it has done it, it has reaped the benefits of it. It needs to re-adopt this as its full-time agenda.
We promised our viewers and listeners that we would speak more on other issues other than Sofia, but we are running out of time. And I think there's a lot to digest about what you said and what we heard about Sofia, what it signifies, etc. But in sum, if I have to summarize what you're saying, I think it is fair to say that Turkey's deep political crisis, cultural crisis, social crisis, is an economic crisis, is deepening. And we are now in the depths of that crisis. There is not any sort of flicker of hope for the opposition or for any challenges to the current power structure. I think we should leave it there because there is a lot more to say about it. We will, I'm sure, talk about foreign policy issues in our next conversation. But let's leave it there. And Thank you, Merve from POMED, and thank you, Sinan Ciddi from Marine Corps University in Virginia, Washington, D.C. Talk to you again.
Ahval podcastlerini tüm mobil telefonlarda Spotify, SoundCloud ve Spreaker üzerinden dinleyebilirsiniz. Apple iPhone kullanıcıları bize iTunes üzerinden de ulaşabilir. Türkiye'nin ve hayatın cıvıl cıvıl sesleri Ahval Podcast dizisinde. Kulağınız bizde olsun.